I'm almost reluctant, Shannon, to wish people a happy holiday Monday, because when you're doing a podcast, people listen. They might be listening. It could be October by the time they get around to listening to this.
Yeah. Yeah. But you were obviously up early today, though, Bob, right? You were up very early, right?
Yes. Why?
Well, I mean, Canada beat the Americans in women's soccer in Tokyo.
Oh, yes, I did hear that.
No, you didn't watch? You weren't up at 4 Eastern time, Bob?
To watch a soccer game?
Cheering on Christine Sinclair and our great Canadian women?
Well, I do. I am a big fan of Ms. Sinclair and the rest of her teammates and their success. And now they get a chance at a gold medal.
Indeed.
Now I'm thinking this is for the first time they've had it. This is their first shot at a gold medal, right?
Oh yeah. Yeah. We have been stuck on bronze the last couple of times.
So, yeah. But they're very good.
2012. I don't know if you remember 2012. We were ahead 3-0 on the Americans. The Americans came back and beat us screw any chance that we had of winning the gold medal. But this is just I think the fourth time in, gosh, I was going to say 65 times, fourth time in 65 times that we've beaten the Americans in women's soccer. So this is a big day.
Well, what does it say? We have had, as I sit here, and I will stand corrected. I'm not 100% sure. But DeGrasse's bronze medal in the 100 was the first medal won by Canada by a male.
No, there was an archery bronze too. In fairness, there was a bronze medal won on the arch by the archery team by a young gentleman out of Toronto.
I'd stand corrected.
Yeah.
But this is an Olympic Games in terms of Canada has been dominated by female success.
Just tremendous. Tremendous.
Can we analyze this in any way, shape, or form?
No, we can't. Other than, we should be saluting what our Canadian female athletes have done, and quite frankly, it all goes back in many ways at times to the opportunities that our female athletes get at U.S. colleges to perform and to compete. And Canada has been a huge beneficiary of Title IX, which is years and years and years ago now, where they have to offer scholarships and they have. The American colleges have come to Canada to take advantage of our great athletes.
Well, they've also done that in terms of basketball for men as well as women.
And
have been doing it forever for hockey. But
other sports, it's truly amazing that what we've done. And when you think about how successful our rowing programs have become again and our swimming programs have become again. Predominantly on the backs of our great female athletes.
Well, perhaps at some point we'll have a conversation about with somebody who knows more than we do, which is probably just about everybody, on whether there is something specific that has happened that has allowed our female athletes to succeed at a rate far beyond what the male athletes have, at least.
Well, the one obvious answer is that most of our, And I know this is a generalization, so don't get mad at me if you're listening, but most of our athletes in our country that are male decide to play hockey. There's something to be said for that.
There is something to be said for that. Although historically, I think I'd be right in saying that there's been a dramatic shift in the last 50 years where male athletes tended to be of higher profile, greater success in Olympic Games, Canadian male athletes than female athletes. And that is completely now flipped around.
Why has it ever?
It's nothing but cyclical. Mm-hmm. We'll talk a little bit about this kind of stuff with our guest today. Alan Abel joins us from suburban Washington. I don't know if he's downtown or on the outskirts of Washington, D.C. One of the truly great sports writers of his time and a fascinating guy. If you haven't seen him before on this program, watch today. Alan Abel, when we come back after these messages. Hey, it's McCowan, it's Shannon on this holiday Monday. We hope you're all enjoying yourselves. If you're listening to this or watching this on the holiday Monday, Alan Abel joins us, to chat about, well, we don't know yet. But in the preamble to this formal discussion, we were just yakking about the Olympics, and you haven't had any interest or involvement in the Olympic Games for a long time, right?
Well, I did. I did some pieces for CBC TV in Pyeongchang, in Korea. I guess it's 5 years ago now. Mm-hmm. So involvement in a professional way is different from an involvement in an atavistic or a fan way. We were talking about my first Olympics in Montreal 45 years ago, when I was a 26-year-old sports writer from across the border in Albany, and was incredibly dazzled by the pageantry, by the ceremony, by the protocol, by the internationalism, by the East versus West in those days of the Iron Curtain. And I'd have to say that dazzle has worn off, but probably it would in almost any enterprise since then. But I was just mesmerized at being at the Olympic Games, at the Games of the 21st Olympiad, and now we're at the 32nd Olympiad. And I suspect that young people are still just as dazzled if it's sold properly. But whether it's fair to say I was younger, I just had bought into the swifter, higher, stronger, the gathering of the youth of the world, the idea of amateurism, which certainly existed in many of the sports then, even as they were searching for anyone who would ever claimed a filthy penny, as they had with Jim Thorpe 60 years earlier. So there was a time when the Olympic star burned very, very brightly for me, and truly believed in what de Coubertin had set out, or at least made out that he was attempting to establish.
But we were in a time, I think we've forgotten, Alan, and maybe you agree or disagree, that those Olympics were Olympics of boycotts. There was always a boycott, whether it was 76 or 80 or 84. The politicization of amateur sports was maybe at its highest in those days, don't you think?
I don't recall that Montreal was heavily boycotted. I don't recall, and I'm sure your viewers remember better than I do, about South Africa's status at that time during the apartheid era. But the main boycott, of course, was the U.S., was Jimmy Carter saying, many nations will go to Moscow, ours will not go. And so the U.S. stayed home, Canada stayed home. And then in 84 was the reciprocal boycott by the Soviet-controlled countries. Mm-hmm. Also remember that China did not take part. What we now consider mainland China, communist China, the People's Republic, did not take part until 1984. They sent a couple of athletes, I believe, to Helsinki in 1952. And then it was Taiwan that was China at the Olympic Games, just as it was Taiwan that was China at the United Nations. So you had this the competing boycotts of the 80s. You also had the total absence of China, which at that point, I guess, was too poor or had not decided to commit national resources to winning Olympic medals in the way that the Soviet Union and its satellites did. If you look, compare now China to India, almost equivalent populations. How many medals has India won in Tokyo?
I have no idea.
One. So in those terms, that's what's really different. The biggest difference is China. And the biggest difference is the end of the sham of professionalism, or that the Soviets or the East Germans were amateurs in any way. But that doesn't mean that someone who now is 26 and at the games for the first time and going in the village and living with the other reporters and lining up 20 people in line for the buffet, and the other 19 are from 19 different countries. That's pretty fascinating. Maybe less so now that we're used to having Zoom meetings with people around the world, but it sure was something in 76.
So something changed though for you. Was it an evolutionary change? Did it take a period of time, or was there a single event that created your relative disinterest in these games?
Well, I'm not going to self-flagellate over not being interested in them. If I had been assigned this year by someone to go cover them, I would have covered them with the same avidity and the same enthusiasm. Hopefully at my age, the same interest and the same energy. So I think it's just growing older. I think it's not the only political institution in the world that one could grow disillusioned with. I'm sure there are young people who believe in the United Nations mission. But then you experience what it's achieved or what it stood for or what has held it back for 40, 50, 60 years. And you might call it disillusionment. Weren't you once fascinated with the idea of swifter, higher, stronger and the five rings with one color from every flag in the world and the anthem and the hymn? It's beautiful stuff. And it still works.
I think for me, the drug era, which began in the 70s, effectively, we think, in
particularly with the Eastern Bloc.
With the Eastern Bloc, and particularly with the East Germans, sort of soured me in the beginning. And then as I grew a little bit older and more interested in the business side of it, I came to realize that the IOC is a relatively corrupt institution, and the ideals that they preach are not consistent with the methods that they use to conduct these games. And those things kind of soured me. And then, maybe not unlike you, Abel, when I went to Vancouver, my first and only Olympic Games, I was mesmerized, as you suggested I would be, or the people would be. When you go to the games, it's easy to fall into the trap, yes?
I don't want to declare it a trap. That's your word, not mine. I mean, it is true that in the late 70s, when I was mesmerized by the internationalism of the games at Montreal, anyone in Toronto could have experienced the same thing at the Chin Picnic or by walking into Honest Ed's. If there were 20 people online at the cash at Honest Ed's, likely 19 separate countries were represented there too. And that was for Toronto. Do you remember Toronto Caravan?
Mm-hmm. Well, of course.
Eating, right. I mean, there were three curmudgeonly elderly men here speaking, but I don't want to
speak for yourself there. Speak for yourself.
Let's say we're all over 21, but I don't want to denigrate idealism. I'm a dad, and I hope my daughter, if she gets to go to the games when she's 26 in some capacity, that she's as mesmerized as I am. But there is a difference. Professionalism is different. The dream team changed a lot of things. Mm-hmm.
For the better, do you think, Alan?
I guess so. I guess if you remember the sham in 72, where they replayed the last 2 seconds of the USSR basketball final and the supposed Soviet American amateurs or the Canadian hockey teams in world championships. And I mean, that was a sham as well. Also, that era, I don't mind the dream team being there. Imagine if they weren't there now. Well, you saw the Canadian hockey team the last time, right?
Yeah.
Trying to sell them as lovable small town strivers, that doesn't work anymore.
Well, is there something you would change? Is there something you see that is problematic in this evolution of these games? And as you've documented, we grew up in an era where the ideal was that these were amateur athletes.
Well, that was the idea on the NCAA too, right? And that's been a fiction for decades.
Well, sure.
It's been a fiction for generations. I don't have any problem with major college athletes being paid. I know quite a few Olympic athletes, former Olympic athletes, including gold medal winners. And they are different from us. They're different at a level of obsession, at a level of dedication, at a level of sacrifice that most of us can't achieve. And in a level, obviously, of inborn skill and talent and genetics, we were looking up yesterday, Zverev, who won the men's tennis singles. Both of his parents were professional tennis players. We looked up the Russian woman who played for Switzerland. Both her parents were professional athletes. It's not something that just anyone can aspire to, but I think maybe they've added some events now where where, quote, ordinary people can aspire to. I don't want to argue against the evolution of the Olympic Games, that it should all be back to 1912, where Jim Thorpe is thrown out for accepting a few bucks for playing semi-pro baseball.
Mm-hmm. The interesting thing, you talk about that, the evolution of the sports. My biggest complaint, having been to eight, is I think the summer games, these games, the actual real Olympic games, because they actually aren't called the summer games. They're just called the Olympic games. And it's the winter games that are different. The summer games are actually way too big. They're so big. There's so many things happening. It's difficult to keep track. And perhaps that's, as you talked about, that's my age. But do you think the modernization, the growth of the X Games style sports have helped the Olympics?
I don't know if they've hurt them in any way. If you're a fan of what's new, speed climbing, breakdancing, surfing.
Yeah.
Well, then you want to watch the Olympic breakdancing, and you honor and celebrate the idea that you're finally part of this carnival. But if you are a modern pentathlete, or for that matter, a rower or a boxer or a weightlifter, any of the sports that existed in 1896, it's still there for you. Have you ever been to a World's Fair?
Sure.
The thing to compare the 76 Olympic Games to is Expo 67. There's more than you could see in a day there too.
Mm-hmm.
There was an enormity, an infinity of things you could see. And I've been to lots of World's Fairs since then. And it's the World's Fair. It's the Olympic Games. Of course, there's a multitude. Of course, there's an overabundance. That's, as long as people are willing to support and pay for it, then why not keep having it?
The U.S. television.
I'm old, but not bitter.
Well, I'm a little bitter. There.
Now you had television. You had more fun, though, Bob. You just.
Oh, I acknowledge it.
You were in awe of what was going on the streets of Vancouver, even without going to the venues. It was fantastic.
I acknowledge that, and I said that to Alan earlier. I had a terrific time, an unexpectedly good time. I did not want to go. I went reluctantly, and made a few. I insisted on a few things had to happen in order for me to go. And when they did, I was kind of trapped, and wasn't really looking forward to it, but had a wonderful time, and I wouldn't exchange it for anything. So I understand that from being there.
Mm-hmm.
But the perspective that, sorry,
I understand. Think about being there and having that pass around your neck, having that E-pass, or sure, if you're consorting with the gods on Olympus, the A-pass.
Mm-hmm.
It is a vision of a world in which we're all credentialed. We're segmented into different hierarchies. You can go through this door, but not that door.
Yep.
You can go into the village, but not into this particular room in the village. And it is, it makes one very proud to have that credential around one's neck. And I can say that the dozen games that I worked, nine for CBC TV, worked harder, slept less, traveled more, and had a better time than anything else, because it is so large and so vast and so difficult to encompass. Maybe it's easier when it's occurring in a time zone in Asia to boil it all down for a primetime package, but when it's going live, it's never ending. It's just a whirlwind, and it is, it's a fabulous thing to be part of. Absolutely. And the team spirit. Man. And I remember saying, like, people would complain, I got 3 hours sleep last night. I didn't sleep at all. You're on air till midnight, then you're up at 7 to go cover some other event. But there was, if you look at the Olympic program, there's sailing and there's shooting and there's softball and there's swimming, but there's no sleeping. It was a tremendous grind and a tremendous sense of accomplishment and teamwork.
Is there one or two stories or one or two people from your past at the Olympics that jumps out?
Well, in 76, the lesser press like me from the Albany Times Union then were housed at the University of Montreal up the mountain. In fact, we the road cycling race went right past where we were staying. And every night at precisely 1 o'clock in the morning, the buildings were in the student dorms arranged around the courtyard. And at exactly 1 o'clock in the morning, a voice would come bellowing out of one of the windows. And every night of the games, "I hate this place." And heard it once, and I'm not customarily someone who's up at 1 o'clock in the morning, but I know then I was covering two or three events, writing a daily column and a list of notes, and still being there at 1 a.m., "I hate this place." And I learned later that it was a name you might ever have heard. It was a guy named Wells Twombly, who I think was from the Los Angeles Herald Examiner, quite a prominent sports writer in those days. And I imagine he had been accustomed to Hiltons and Sheridans and Intercontinentals in his career, much as we became accustomed to them later. Mm-hmm. And here he was sharing a dorm room. I was sharing a dorm room with someone, I think, from Peru or someplace. And I don't think he ever came back to the room. And the food was terrible. And the lineups for the buses were intolerable. And it was hot. And it was far, far away from anything, any place you wanted to be. But it was the Olympic Games, and to a rookie, it was mesmerizing. But to a veteran like Wells Twombly, it was, "I hate this place."
What?
And what I have a lot of Olympic memories. I was there for the Miracle on Ice and in Lake Placid, and was at Nadia Comaneci's perfect 10 score in the Forum in Montreal, and many since then. But what the memory, after being hypnotized, well, hey, there's a guy next to me on the bus. Hey, he's from Fiji. I never been to Fiji.
Right.
I'll give you one more in Montreal at a basketball game. The guy sitting next to me, burly, swarthy person, and referee made some call. I think what Puerto Rico was playing, because they have their own Olympic committee. And the guy next to me says, like, "That referee, what a terrible call. That's the kind of call. He must be Greek." And then another call, like, "Yeah, I'm sure that referee's a Greek." And does it again, like, "Yeah, he's a Greek. Yeah, a Greek, the referee's a Greek." And I said, "Are you a Greek?" He said, "Sir, I'm a Turk." That's how you learn about the world on a personal basis. But again, you can do all that now on a Zoom call. So 1976 is a very, very different time, as it should be. And the Olympic Games have changed since then, as they should. They've stopped the sham of amateurism. The Soviet bloc is gone. China is in and dominating as they should. In some way, it hasn't changed all that much. And the more you read about 1896, in Athens and 1900 in Paris and 1904 in St. Louis, it's not all that different either. The Coubertin hit a nerve when he tried to revive the ancient games, and it worked. It worked beautifully. It was the same age when the Red Cross was founded, the same age as the Boy Scouts were founded. And some of these have struck a human universal, and the Olympics have, and more power to them. And if the IOC can get away with it, good for them.
You have had.
I wish I was on the IOC.
You've had the ability. I was going to say privilege, and maybe it is a privilege, to have watched and worked on Canadian coverage of the Olympic Games, while being well aware of the U.S. coverage of the Olympic Games, particularly most recently. Whether it was TSN, Sportsnet, CBC, a combination of the three. What we have now is essentially, I don't know, 10, 12 channels devoted to the Olympics. So at any time of the day, you can see almost anything you want and you will see it live. The US television networks have taken a different approach to it and essentially pared it down principally, at least on the main network, in this case, NBC, to taped coverage, highlight packages of things that had gone on before. Is that the right approach? Does that bother you?
I think they have a better audience research than I do. How many people watch more than an hour of television a night? How many people make themselves available to watch television at 2 p.m. or 4 a.m. rather than at 8 p.m. And how many people are buying the products sold by sponsors at 4 a.m. or 2 p.m. I have no, I'm not your best source on that. I'm sure that NBC has the best audience research imaginable.
And they,
they know exactly what people want. Ask Shannon, you're the, I mean, you've been in the, in that same business. You present what your sponsors believe that their customers want to mm-hmm. see.
Well, NBC has really done a good job allowing their cable side, and they own about 8 cable networks to carry all the stuff live. And then they distill everything down for primetime. What the Americans do, having been on both sides of the border for Olympics, what the Americans do is they analyze every minute of a show. So that they will sit down with a spreadsheet and say, okay, what did we do at 8:04 that people liked? Because we had more people switch on their televisions at that point for 3 minutes. And then they changed their channel. The analysis, you're right, Alan, the analysis and the science of research when it comes to what the viewers like. The interesting thing, though, is and I don't know whether you found this in the stuff that you did, but make no mistake about it. The consumer who watches the Olympics, I think in most countries, is driven by females and female consumers, and because there's a broader understanding of what the Olympics mean to people, for women. And I think that that's an important thing to understand. Did you ever feel that?
Absolutely. No, we knew that decades ago.
Yeah.
Figure skating and gymnastics.
Yeah.
Obviously, there are a lot more women's sports now than there were then. But figure skating and gymnastics. And it's not just about dreams of little girls who go to the baby gym the day after they see Komenich or Mary Lou Retton or someone like that on the balance beam. I don't know why three men should act surprised that women are the important part of the audience. Women buy, I believe, I read 80% of the books in North America.
Mm-hmm.
Why the shock and awe that females like to watch sports and like to read books? But it's a science of research. It doesn't take a lot of research on the other side to say, we're going to show the whole Canada hockey game from the drop puck in the first period till the end of the game, even if the score is 11-2. We're going to show the whole game. And we always, again, I was not an executive. It was always, well, we take pride in the fact that we show the events live as they are happening, unfiltered, unedited. We don't, by contrast, boil them down to just the highlight packages of the Americans who are competing. So, two different approaches, but now with all the multiple channels, there's room for both.
Yeah, the interesting thing, Alan, at a certain point when we were doing that, is we had no choice because we didn't have the resources to edit them down.
Exactly, of course not. And didn't have our own cameras in 12 or 14 places at the wrestling or the boxing or the bobsled.
Yeah.
That becomes a resource question. It becomes a question of a network with serving a country with 12 or 15 times the population. And the audience, but you're the broadcast executive, not I.
What are you talking about? I hired you every once in a while. So
that was another poor planning experience on your part.
Yeah, well,
there are more than a few of those historically in Shannon's biography, but let's put that aside. Another topic for discussion, and we'll do that when we come back after these messages. It's McCowan. It's Shannon. Alan Abel is with us. Since last we spoke, Mr. Abel, a fairly significant thing has taken place in the sport of baseball, and that is the changing of the name of the Cleveland baseball team from Indians to Guardians. It does not take effect until next season, but it has been publicly noted. And it's not the first by any stretch. I suspect it will not be the last of these name changes. But in your perspective, what is the impact to you personally of this kind of decision?
The first thing I thought when I heard about the Guardians, and I looked it up and saw that there were the giant statues on the bridge leading into downtown Cleveland. Was why were they the Indians in the first place? We know the history of why the Washington Redskins were the Redskins, because they were owned in Boston. They play in the same stadium as the Boston Braves of the National League Baseball. So there was the equivalent be the Redskins. Why were they the Indians in the first place? And even that seems to be lost in the mists of time. There's the rumor about Native American player Chief Sock Alexis, that they called the team the Indians then, but really they were known as the Naps because Napoleon Lajoie, the great second baseman, was their manager and captain and star. So I have no problem with them not being the Indians anymore. And it's hard. I'm not saying as a little kid I found it hard to stomach, but Chief Wahoo is just, that was just too far. Just like the screaming warrior on the Milwaukee Braves, later the Atlanta Braves uniform. I'm no progressive. I'm not a politically driven by any of this. I have no agenda about it, but they shouldn't have been the Indians and the Braves and the Redskins a long time ago. When I lived in Northern Arizona 20 years ago as a national park ranger, interestingly or conversely, and on the fringe of the Navajo reservation, vast majority Native American population there, the high school teams were the Braves and the Warriors and the Redskins.
Interesting.
Are there Native Americans who wear that Redskins emblem and Chief Wahoo? Absolutely there are. I'm not qualified to analyze why they would do that. At some point, it becomes the same as the Fighting Irish. Are there people who have felt an indignity about the leprechaun with his fists ready for Notre Dame? I don't know. What's the difference between the Fighting Irish and the Indians? More the cartoon face. Remember, in the U.S., that the word Indian is not anathema. It's not part of cancel culture. It's still the National Museum of the American Indian at the Smithsonian. It's still the Bureau of Indian Affairs. It's still very widely and acceptedly called Indian country in the Southwest. So there's not that battle has not been joined, fought, or declared over in the U.S. There still are, if you went to Navajo land or Hopi land or Apache land, they still would, they're, constabulary would be the Navajo Indian police, I believe. It would still be the Apache Indian tribe. So that word itself has not been banned. But Chief Wahoo, I think, should have gone a long time ago. And I don't mind Guardians at all. I had assumed when I first heard it was tied in. Is that a Marvel comic, Guardians of the Galaxy?
Yeah, that's what I thought too.
And why not? It's no different from the Mighty Ducks. But why was Chief Wahoo still around in recent years? That's hard to know.
I've taken the position for a long time that three white guys like us should not be making decisions on the merits of any of these names or how much they offend other people. Do you concur with that assessment? Are we being...
Well, I'll throw it back to you with the Fighting Irish. Shannon, have any Irish blood?
I have Irish blood.
Well, to be sure. Do you like the Fighting Irish?
Never bothered me.
I mean, I'm not saying that there should be the Fighting Hebrews, or there shouldn't. I don't know. What's the nickname of Yeshiva University? I don't know. Are they the Rampaging Rabbis? I don't know.
The issue for me is who should be making these kinds of decisions, and are these decisions being made presumptuously by white people who believe, well, maybe we are offending Native North Americans. Maybe.
Well, the survey that the Redskins finally did showed 90% approval of the existing name among Native American panels.
And yet that name has been dissolved.
But that that asked the question, is 10% enough to make the change? That becomes really the key, is if you insult or you challenge one person and to say that it bothers me, is that a reason enough to change? And I think there are lots of people that say, yeah, if you do that, then there is reason for change.
The Redskins phenomenon here in Washington, and again, I'm not your best resource on this. When I've gone to Redskins games and sat in the upper balcony, it's vast majority African-American up there, not the corporate boxes, not down by the field. I have sensed and I've read and I've heard that maybe not today, but historically in Washington, that African-Americans identified with the Redskin as a subject of persecution, as an object of outcast status, and identified. Obviously, they couldn't have been called the Washington Africans.
Right.
But that they identified with that figure, that face, that profile, maybe without the feather, that was a source of pride, not only for many Native Americans, but for African Americans in Washington as well. I'm not the best evidence of that. But I don't think it was the people in the upper deck who made the decision to change the name.
Well, clearly. I mean, have you heard much about the Atlanta Braves and their plans? They seem to be next in line. Maybe the Golden
State Warriors. Why not the Kansas City Chiefs were named not for any particular tribe of Indian, but for... I think it's a youth organization in Kansas City that the owner or the mayor or the local, I guess it was the mayor who brought the team to Kansas City, was a chief of this youth organization. That's where they're called the Chiefs. Then they adopted the arrowhead, of course,
right,
and those kind of tokens. But what were the Philadelphia Warriors? My daughter's high school tennis team, they're the Warriors. And I'm surprised that name persists just because of its bellicose connotations. I'm surprised they're not called the Recyclers or the Environmentalists. Maybe it all swings that way. Braves, Warriors. Remember, Stanford were the Indians, right?
Yes, Stanford University. Yeah, they were. Yeah. Yeah. And I was
Dartmouth. Dartmouth was the Indians, and Dartmouth University was founded with a proviso that a certain number of Native American students be admitted.
University of North Dakota was the Fighting Sioux for so many years.
Well, they went on. That was about the mosaic on the floor of the arena, right, or outside the arena.
Mm-hmm.
Then you have the Florida State Seminoles, who perpetuate the name with the cooperation and the co-profiting, I guess, of the Seminole Indian Nation. That they profit from the merchandise. They have an agreement where the Seminole tribe or people or First Nation, if you want to call them that, get a share of the revenue. And it is, in fact, a Seminole who rides the horse onto the field with the football team. I don't think you could take a portion of the Cleveland baseball team's profits and distribute them among every Cherokee and Chippewa and Sioux in the country. Then you could say they've bought into it, but Chief Wahoo still would have to go.
Well, yeah, and I don't think anybody would disagree with that assessment.
Then what about the Leprechaun, the Fighting Irish?
Well, again, I mean, I'm of Irish heritage. It means, to be honest with you, until you brought it up, it never even occurred to me. I'm not a fan of Notre Dame. I don't care that they're the Fighting Irish. I never thought about the connotation. It meant nothing to me. Mm. Now, that doesn't mean that I'm right and somebody who's offended by it is wrong. I'm just trying. I have tried for many, many years since this subject came up, and I don't even know how long ago, as a dominant topic of conversation periodically, trying to figure out what's the right approach here. I'm not offended by these names, but I understand if other people are. You know, we've raised the subject of 90% of Redskins fans like the name, or we're not offended by the name.
Well, that's 90% of Native Americans
yeah,
who were polled on the name.
Okay.
Are there people who are offended by the Scotsman and the tartan and the tam on Canadian Tire Money? And if so, did they
make heard of one, but...
You know what? Did they make that objection public? I don't know.
Well, but if, you know, John said earlier, if one person is offended, is that cause to change?
Right.
Well, that being the case, if that's true, the legitimacy of that offense is going to come into issue because you'd have to change everything. I'm quite certain that every nickname that exists, whether it's for a sporting team, a college, whatever it is, somebody out there will claim to be offended by it. Whether they actually are or not, I don't know.
But that's the way that there is a perception that that is the way we're going, Bob. That just is, you know, how and social media helps propagate that and creates
now you're these conversations. You're just being old and bitter now.
No, I'm not being bitter. I'm just I'm you know, I'm not as old as you yet. You know, I seem to be catching up to you, but I'm not as old as you yet.
The margin remains the same.
The percentage doesn't, but the margin does.
Well, one of the other ones that's changed recently is the Edmonton Eskimos, who have now, what are they, the Elks now?
Yes, they are the Edmonton Elks.
The Eskimos.
That's fine too. That's fine too. That's just fine.
You're all right with that.
Absolutely.
Where are you with the Blackhawks, Alan?
Well, there's another
their name for a person. Their name for a specific person, right? Chief Blackhawk.
Yes.
Who fought in the Black Hawk War against the United States, in which Abraham Lincoln fought on the other side.
And then the Black Hawk name was transferred.
It was two words, then it was one word, right?
Yeah.
I think it's like the Florida State Seminoles, and a specific example like that. Not my decision. It's obviously, it's a great logo. It's a great uniform, but they would be no worse a hockey team if they were the Chicago Bumblebees.
Well, they might even be better. Who knows? But
they got a goalie now, at least.
The issue with the Blackhawks is more the logo than it is the name.
Again, like I think it was with Cleveland. What if you had a team called the Mandelas?
Well, but wait, let me go back here, you know, rather than get into the Mandela argument.
Well, I'm just saying.
I don't disagree.
Was a specific person.
I don't disagree in any way with your assessment of the Cleveland situation and Chief Wahoo. And what I would say is the Indians, before they changed their name to Guardians, made significant efforts to eliminate. They eliminated the logo, essentially. The script of the name across the uniform continued to exist. They changed, instead of having the logo, the former logo on the hat, it became the C. Mm-hmm. They made those moves and then clearly felt it wasn't enough.
Yeah, they made those moves defensively.
Well, everybody's
not for me to ascribe their motive. Look, I grew up eating at Sambo's restaurant. You remember Sambo's?
Sure, sure.
Right. Remember Sambo's? If you grew up in Britain, you might have grown up reading about the Gollywogs. There's a comic strip in the paper was Joe and Asbestos. Think about what media was perpetuating or showing in those years. And I'm not going to use the word progress, but certainly can use the word evolution or change. If I'm a student at Stanford, I don't think I want the team to be called the Indians. And that was 40 or 50 years ago.
Right.
When a consciousness arose. And was it just a few radical students beating a drum? Possibly. Possibly. But were they on the right side of history? Probably. Probably they were. And I think it was time for Chief Wahoo to go. It's probably time for the Atlanta Braves to go. Chief Nakahoma's long gone. Mm-hmm. Remember his son knock a single. And tomahawk chop and those kind of things. If only a few people are offended by it, but they're vocal and they can sway an audience, then more power to them. That's sort of how democracy works, right?
Well, we're in the midst of this.
Every generation that's ever lived has been in the midst of something.
Yes.
Of course.
It's not unique to our time.
As a Washington area resident. I don't know if you're a fan of the Redskins or the former Redskins. What is your sense of what will happen with that name?
I think they've been brilliant. Just going to the local supermarket and there are racks of Washington football team merchandise.
Yeah.
So it's perpetuated another year or two. Remember when Bavese, now we'll go back in our wheelhouse here.
Mm-hmm. All right.
Remember when Bavese said 7 years, then you changed the logo? Now, I remember that. 7 years, then we changed the logo. When people complained about it was trite, it was silly, it was a maple leaf in the bird's face. Yeah, 7 years, we'll change the logo. Then we have to sell, everybody has to buy a new hat.
Yeah.
That was his summation of it.
Now in professional sports, it's 7 weeks.
Yeah, we'll it should be. It's business. Of course it should be. There's no problem with that. But Washington football team, an increasing number of people around here have the new logo on the hat, and they wear the new shirt and the new T-shirt and the new bumper sticker. So in terms of merchandise, there's no reason to change it now. There's talk about maybe there'll be the Red Tails, which would work because that was the Tuskegee Airmen, to whom the name supposedly needs to pay tribute soon, were also called the Red Tails, or their planes had red paint on the tails. So wait a couple of years until everyone who needs or wanted under the Christmas tree a new cap with the current logo, no one wants to have the old logo any more than anyone wants to still be driving an Oldsmobile. Once everyone is up to date with whatever can be purchased, change it again. 7 years, we change the logo.
So just out of maybe, business.
Right? What should they be called? How about the Guardians?
The Football Guardians.
Football Guardians. Otherwise, I grew up with the New York
Football Giants.
People of my generation still call them the Football Giants.
Sure.
Well, to that point, if you walk into the grocery store in suburban Washington, and there's a conversation about the football team, what are they referring them to? Did you see the team play? I mean, if they don't use the word Redskins play, did you see the football
you
know team what? Play?
If you say the word Redskin out loud, you are seen as perpetuating what needs to go away. I think you'd see the same thing in Cleveland. There will be some people of whatever political persuasion, whether they've got the vaccine or not, who are going to insist on calling them the Indians. For as long as they feel they get some affirmation from their peers for saying it. And I'm sure there are people here who take great delight in calling them the Redskins and the Skins. And we'll still
what's
sing
the alternative
hail to the Redskins.
Just call them Washington.
Well, that's sort of co-opting the way soccer teams are named, right?
Yes.
That's like Barcelona FC or Inter Milan. I call them Inter Washington.
I think that's the MLS team there, isn't it?
If you want to segment, I mean, the population's segmented enough now, it's divided enough now. Great human impetus is to gain status within your tribe and within your tribe of buddies at the bar. If you want to be defined and insist on calling them the Redskins, fine, go ahead. If you're going to be ostracized for not using that name from that group, then you probably won't stop using that name. That's not about, in that situation, it's not about the team. It's about the individual fans and how they feel among their buddies mm-hmm. and what their buddies' politics are. Whether these are the same people who are saying, you know, Trump really did win the election. What was it 73% of Republicans I saw in the survey believe that Donald Trump is still the president? Or they feel it is important for their status within their tribe to tell a pollster that idiocy.
That they believe that.
That they believe that.
Yeah.
I think it's the same as 10 guys sitting around saying, yeah, Trump won. Trump's still the president. Yeah, President Trump. Or, yeah, the Redskins won last night. Even if that point they are the Red Tails or the Guardians or the Recyclers.
Mr. Abel, you had you were questioning the topics that we might want to discuss.
Yeah,
we only got two. I had a whole list.
Fire away, John.
No, we're going to let you go. We're going to save the other topics for another time. Sure. And there's no shortage of it, but you see, you
don't press your luck.
You did survive with just a couple things that
came. Okay, just plug the book. Plug the book.
The Short Life of Huey McClune, A True Story of Baseball, Magic, and Murder. It is the biography of the former mascot of the Philadelphia A's who ran a speakeasy working for the mob in Philadelphia while at the same time working for the Philadelphia police force and got gunned down in a hail bullets, 1928. True story.
By the way, I have a few people on social media that have listened to your previous visits on our show.
Me too.
And
bought the book.
They have bought the book.
And but have they read the book?
And they read the book and enjoyed the book. So there you go.
That's the triple crown. Buy, read, enjoy. Then you have to go for the grand slam, which is tell your friends.
Well, we just did.
Many thanks, gents.
We thank you as always. We'll look forward to seeing you somewhere down the road. Thank you, Mr. Abel.
Bye-bye.
Alan Abel, we'll be back after these messages. Again, our thanks to Alan Abel for joining us. He had great concern about the topic of conversation and we couldn't shut him up.
I was prepared, because Alan always gets worried. We ended up talking about two things, two things. And he's one of my favorite people. I've had the great benefit of working with Alan and building content with Alan. And he's one of those guys you trust and he can see things within a story that the rest of us can't. And that's what makes him so good.
Quickly before we go, it is not my intent or desire to stick a pin in the Toronto Blue Jays balloon, which is now floating, having won four in a row and all three of their games since they've come back home, sweeping Kansas City. But the acquisition of Berríos really suddenly makes this starting rotation look very, very solid. And I know there have been additions in the bullpen, and we haven't seen enough of that bullpen probably to get a true assessment of it. But has this team got a chance, do you think?
I do, and I think one of the reasons they do have a chance is their schedule. When you look at who they play, they tons of games against teams like Kansas City, like Minnesota, like Baltimore.
Detroit.
And Detroit. And therefore, when you take a look at the competitive level of the teams they're playing versus what the Yankees play or who Seattle plays or Oakland, you know what? There's a chance. Absolutely.
The only thing about baseball is, and I think you will attest to this, is that that philosophy probably works less in baseball than it does in almost any other sport.
Yeah, you're probably right.
A good hockey team will beat a bad hockey team almost all the time. And the same with football and same with basketball. In baseball, we don't, there are teams that have been stumbling. Tampa Bay, when they were the worst team in baseball, used to beat up on the Toronto Blue Jays.
Yeah.
When they were good. So we'll keep our fingers crossed, but all of a sudden this team looks like it's got a chance. And, we'll watch with great interest over the next couple of months to see if they can pull it off. We thank everybody for watching or listening. Well, we'll let you go. Enjoy. If you're enjoying this on the holiday Monday, have a great day. Weather here in Toronto looks perfect. Get out and have fun. For Shannon McCowan, we'll see you next time. Goodbye, everybody.